Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Hey everybody, this is Jeremy with Slate House Lit Bits, Slate House Publishing.
Man, you really need to write this down.
Every freaking time.
Every time.
Every freaking time.
And you made the name.
I did make
you
the name.
You named it. Slate House Publishing presents Lit Bits.
Can it be a tongue twister if you created the tongue twister? Like, how does that... Anyway, this is...
sounds like a branding problem. we should have done the market research.
Well, it was like Podbean or one of them, or Anchor, whichever one I'm posting to, said, you know, we recommend you shorten the name. <I'm> like, really? You mean I get it wrong every time I say it?
Yeah, we're recording too late.
Yeah, you guys know what we are. You've seen the logo. Here's our new episode. Yeah, this is Jeremy, and with me as always is Curtis and Trevor. And, well, Trevor always, and, you know, for the past few episodes, Curtis, so he's our...
Again, he's only been absent for one episode, but now
That's
he's
true.
A permanent member of our cast.
Now he's actually got a mic. And
yeah.
Today we're really, really excited to welcome Karen Huff, who is the author of Ground Control through Lights Out Inc., and she is also one of the editors here at Slate House. So we wanted to kind of do something a little different for this episode. We wanted to do an interview with Karen and just kind of get to know her a little bit better and just have a little conversation. So, hey, Karen, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. I know you and I have talked numerous times, but this is your first time with the Wayne Howard Studio guys and with like your second or third time with Trevor.
I think it's just the second time.
Second time.
We've corresponded just very like a small amount.
I've seen your tweets. I've seen your tweets back and forth. So
Yeah. It was this is really fun. I bought Karen's book, right? Ground Control to read it to talk about today, which I absolutely loved. But as I was reading it, you know, I was talking to my wife about it and she was like, this sounds like a really good book. And I'm like, yeah, that's because it's a really good book. She was like, isn't he like a really big name? And I was like, well, you know, Karen's a she, for one thing,
believe it or not.
I bought a copy also. And I was one of your ARCs. So, one of your ARC reviewers. So, and I really like the book too. Why did you, I guess let's start there with that because of your wife's confusion. I know it says on the cover, K.A. Huff. Yep. So why did you choose to go with just your initials instead of like your full name?
Oh, I don't know if you've paid attention to social media for the last few years, but I have been given the worst name on the planet. So self-identifying as Karen is just it's not an option right now.
It'll pass,
so
I think.
That is actually why.
Wow.
It's thanks, Mom. Yeah. So they couldn't have known in the 70s, but that happened to me, and so I'm fighting the good fight against being a Karen. And I tried a whole bunch of different nom de plume, and my husband, like, he put them all down. He's like, "That's not even a real name." I'm like, "I know, but it's still better than." The name I was given.
So what were some of the alter egos that you wanted to go with? I'm really curious.
Okay. Some turned out to be actually really inappropriate, but I didn't know. And so he has this kind of knowledge that I don't. And so when we watch movies, he'll laugh at something. And it'll just be, he's like, "I can't believe they said that as a joke. That's so dirty." I'm like, "Well, I don't know what that means." And he'll look at me. He'll say, "Don't Google it." And I'm like, "Well, what do you know these things are?" So, there's a few that I went through. I tried to combine like my first name and my middle name. And I had like Callison or Kerrison. And he was just like, just no.
It's like,
no, just use your name. I'm like,
Like no. Renesmee from Twilight or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I had a spreadsheet of nom de plumes. And them all down.
That feels like such a Karen thing to do. Like it's such a you thing to do to have like a spreadsheet of like all, like potential names that you could use. I love that.
So, yeah. So, anyway, so that's why I went with. Just my initials, and yes,
I like it.
I do too. I mean, I think Jeremy, you did the same thing with you went with J.R. Billingsley.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I think I don't know. I think there's some kind of that ambiguity of the, that adds a little bit of ambiguity to the author, and I think it takes away some kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too meta about this, but like it takes away some of the maybe biases or preconceived notions like a potential reader might have about
about the book written by Karen.
Right, this is a book by Karen.
No, I think that's an interesting point too, right? Like when publishing things, I think that we worry a lot about the marketability of a name or the marketability of something. I know, you know, in like old-timey times, like putting a woman's name on a book meant it wasn't going to sell well, right? So so you'd have them either write under a pen name or they would, you know, use their initials instead, because I think there's a kind of, I don't know, at least traditionally kind of a masculinity in using just initials to publish something, right?
Yes, yeah. Well, that's what the Brontes did. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
That is.
I
in theory, we've come a long way, but...
Yeah, I hate the Brontes. I'm just throwing it out there.
No, tell us how you really feel, Trevor.
This is a true story. Like, I had a really bad encounter with Jane Eyre in high school. Right, like my teacher in high school.
How do you have a bad encounter with a book?
You know,
she like trapped you in the bathroom and pantsed you or something.
You know what? Jane Eyre did that. Jane Eyre, she charged in. I was like, "Who are you?" She said, "I am Jane Eyre," and she pantsed me and she ran off.
Swirly.
It was terrible.
She's got a record.
No, but my
troubled individual.
Yeah, my high school teacher was just she was a lunatic and she'd say, "Read Jane Eyre," and I was like, "All right, I'll read this book. It's not my thing." And I read it and you know, as with everything, I read everything for kind of like the beats. I read for, you know, kind of like the emotional arc, the thematic elements. And she was like one of those, like, no, you have to, if you don't read closely, then you're not reading. And so on all of her quizzes, she would ask stuff like, "What is the color of Jane Eyre's eyes?" I'm like, who the fuck cares? Like, so since really? That point forward, I've been like, to hell with the Brontes. Like, they can all just burn for what they've done to...
So I had this not quite the same experience with being pantsed by Margaret Atwood.
By Jane.
So in high school, I don't know if it's required reading at all in the U.S., but in Canada, Margaret Atwood she's considered a god.
Oh, yeah.
She's incredible. Like her story, like her background of her own upbringing is just phenomenal. And then the book she's written, they stand up. They're amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But when you're forced to read a book in high school, it's never the same. And so we had to do The Handmaid's Tale, of course. Right. And I never quite got behind it just because it was required reading in high school. And then I finally went back to it, I'm going to say 4 years ago. I was in a library and I was like, well, fine, I'll pick up an Atwood book. And I didn't pick up that one. I picked up like Oryx and Crake, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I read it and I was like, oh, wow, this is really good. And then so I went back and I picked up another one and another one. And then I took her master class, and like, I spent 30 years avoiding her writing because of high school, and that's and that's kind of a shame. So I think you should give the Brontes.
All right, to my credit, I taught an honors world lit class here at the university, and in my honors world lit class, I purposefully left a whole unit open, and I said, you know, we will read what you want to read. So, you know, kind of as this class project, I said, I want you guys to come up with, like, you know, who is an author from this time period that you would like to read? And the only ones that got any votes were the Bronte sisters. And I think that was maybe because I said anyone from this period of time except the Bronte sisters.
So naturally.
And, yeah, so naturally. So the whole class chose the Brontes. We did a unit on the Brontes, and so I actually went out to read some of their kind of collected fiction, because the Bronte sisters, like growing up, they created this shared universe that they wrote in, and they inhabited it with, you know, poetry and fiction, and it was just kind of this weird sprawling mess of like storytelling, and I cannot express to you how bad a time I had. I was like trying to pull it together to be like, how am I going to teach this? Like, what are we going to talk about? It was such a weird experience. I ended up giving the book away to the one kid in the class who was like, I love the Brontes. And I was like, all right, this is for you. Here you go, Lucia.
I don't know if that works. Like, when Karen revisited her despised, you know, author from high school, she went to a good work of art, and you went to, like, potentially, like, one of the worst.
Right, yeah. I found their children, like, the stuff as a kid. Maybe I should go read, what's the, Wuthering Heights? Maybe that's what I should read.
So, Karen, you said you grew up in Canada, but you've had a couple of, well, at least one big kind of, well, no, not that big of a move. It wasn't that huge, was it? It was...
Oh, no. No.
It's only an ocean.
It was only an ocean. It wasn't even the biggest ocean. Like, Pacific's bigger, isn't it?
We chose a small ocean.
Not even the biggest ocean.
How was it? You moved from England to Canada. So how long had it been? How long had you been in England before you moved back to Canada?
We were there for 4 years.
Okay, so that's relatively
not,
short.
Not long, but long enough to put down roots. It's the second longest amount of time I've ever spent in one place. So that's, I guess that's telling.
Oh, 4 years? So,
yep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my dad was in the Navy, and so we moved around every 2 to 3 years when I was a kid, right up till, I guess, high school, grade 11. And so we just would change houses, we'd change cities, change schools. And so when I met my husband, he had this job opportunity, and he's like, I'm thinking about taking this on. I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm used to moving around, so why not? And so we got married and moved out west in Canada to Medicine Hat, which is a small city in Alberta. And we were closer to his family, and it was a 6-hour to 8-hour drive to get to his family. And the neat thing about moving to England is realizing how big a country you're actually from. Because I had no idea how big Canada was, despite having lived literally coast to coast. I've driven through every province. I haven't been to the territories yet, but it's such a huge, huge country. Mm-hmm. And when we lived in Alberta, the 6-hour drive to visit my in-laws, it was actually faster to fly there from Ottawa, where I live now. When we moved to England, it seemed so simple, because we're like, well, it's a 6-hour flight from London to Ottawa, and it's a 6-hour flight from Ottawa to Vancouver. So it just kind of put in perspective how big Canada is and how big the world is. So it was a strange time, a strange move, because I just expected it would be the same as any other move to a new city. my mindset was that, like, we're still technically kind of a colony, so we speak the same language. We still have like we spell color with the U. Like, we're just the same. It shouldn't be a big transition. And so it was a huge culture shock when I got there, because everything, as anybody else would expect, is completely, well, slightly different. But every little thing is slightly different.
Yeah.
And just the vocabulary to, well, like, how to use a bus, the side of the sidewalk you walk on, the fact that they call sidewalks pavements, which still confuses me. So it was a big transition, and that was 4 years. And then when we found out we were moving back, we asked for an extra year because the pandemic we thought shouldn't count. We're like, that year didn't, we shouldn't have that one.
I don't think that year counted for anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mulligans.
So, that was a mulligan.
But they wouldn't let us stay. But so we lived in a flat for 4 years, and it's half of one of my kids' lives is spent there, and
fantastic.
Yeah, so it was a big change to move there. It does feel like coming home to come back to Canada.
Is that
what a journey?
Is that something you prefer? I mean, I moved around a lot as a kid as well, but I like that, you know, solidified within me that desire to have, like, a permanent home and, like, roots and that sort of thing. Is that how you feel, or, like, do you like the nomadic lifestyle, or do you prefer, like, do you like where you are now? Or
I love where I am now. So this is our forever home. in quotes. It'll take forever to fix it up anyway. So,
oh, is that what that means?
So, but it's,
well, you know, the Canadian housing market is pretty rough right now, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So luckily we bought this. We had just moved into this neighborhood. The last house we lived in before this one, we lived there for 6 years. So that was my longest time in one spot. Mm. And so we bought this little house. It was a bit of a disaster. It wasn't a great neighborhood. We bought this house, and within 6 months, Chris came home. He's like, "Hey, how do you feel about London?" And I'm like, just that we're just in this great house, and the kids are out running in the street and having a great time at the dead end, and I've got a fireplace and a glass of wine, and this isn't a good time. We shouldn't go. And I had just signed on for an amazing job at work, and I was just like, "Well, this like any other time, I would have followed you happily, but this isn't it." And he's like, "Well, let me rephrase. We're moving to London." So luckily, we decided to keep the house. So we rented it out while we were gone.
Oh, awesome.
So we were able to come back and have a place to live as opposed to like living in a tent, because the housing market is absolutely insane.
Your main character also has a big move in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say the like thematically speaking,
yeah.
Right?
Is there parallels?
I was going through some stuff when I started writing it. And I don't want to do any spoilers, of course, but when people read it or when they start, I always say, well, I wrote this book and it's not completely autobiographical. So it's right. Not, but there are elements of my own life that like the things that I thought about, things that kind of worked their way into the story. Mm. And then obviously, once you read it, there are some quite severe left turns that like have not happened to me.
I was floored by a couple of those. Legitimately, I started the book. The first 30 pages or so, I felt were a little slow for me. It's an adjustment period, right?
Because
I went in expecting this laser pew-pew sci-fi. Because that's what we expect, you know, from a genre perspective. It's like, you know.
Mm. It's very grounded sci-fi. It is.
And I think that this is like the best kind of sci-fi.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which we can get into. But, you know, I went in with one set of expectations, and that first 30 pages, I was like, this is good, but this is not what I was expecting. You know, from a science fiction novel, and you know, I had to go through that period of adjustment and kind of like gearing myself up for that kind of a story, which is not always the kind of story that I read. And then after that point forward, I sat down to start reading it, and I found myself by the middle of the book just like completely engrossed.
Yeah.
I couldn't put it down. I stayed up late into the night being like, I'm like really invested in this character's journey. There were a couple of points when I knew I was really engrossed, because after something happened, I had to like put the book down and go for a walk. I was like, what? What did you just do? Felt like you just, you know, like ripped the rug out from under me. And I was like, oh no. Like it was I felt so bad for that character. I was like, oh man, she's going through a lot right now.
So before we go in any further into it though, real quick, Karen, do you want to kind of give an overview of the book? Kind of tell our listeners what it's about?
Sure. Well, again, a little bit inspired of my own giant move across the small ocean. it's the story of a woman who she's followed her husband. When they met, she knew who he was and what kind of person he was. He's ambitious and driven and brilliant. And she just kind of tagged along after him. And his job was number one, so they moved every year or two to different opportunities. And as he moved up the ladder in his biology research, the next natural step would be to go into space towards the new Mars colony. And so the book opens with him coming home and saying, "This is it, we're going to Mars." And she's just like, I don't think I'm ready for this. I don't think I want this. And so the slow start is her kind of going back and trying to figure out, like, if she wants it, if she can handle it. It means leaving everything, leaving her parents, all the friends, her job that she's, again, just started to excel at. So there's definitely life parallels. And so it's her focus on leaving the planet and what she needs to do to stay, I guess, sane and human as she starts this whole new adventure that she has no expectations, no ideas about what's going to happen. And then, I guess, finding her place and trying to figure out who she is and what she needs to do to survive in this new reality.
How's yeah.
That? Awesome.
Yeah, that's it. So,
I think what's really interesting about that summary is, like, you really hit on most of the kind of thematic beats that make the story work so well, right? Being an avid reader of science fiction, I know we talk about horror a lot on this, you know, the show, and at least in this first season. Science fiction is really my home, though. Like, that is the genre that would be my go-to genre. We see very little science fiction, though, about kind of like the near future, in terms of space travel and like, you know, what that kind of means for humans. And we spend, we spend even less time, I think, thinking about what it means to transition from being an Earth person to being a Martian. You know, like we're so kind of set and comfortable in this idea of what our society looks like, but we don't necessarily think about, you know, what happens when we do get to Mars. You know, what does it mean for those people who are going to take that journey, and what do they have to go through emotionally to be, you know, kind of ready for that kind of a trek? So this book, I think, what I loved so much about it was that it really was unafraid of looking at this woman's journey and looking at the identity that she had to reconstruct for herself in order to be ready for this mission.
Yeah, what I like about it, Karen, is what you did with this book as far as blending sci-fi, and I feel like it was elevated to high literature because of your character work.
Thank you.
I mean, I feel like it's that great blend of literary and genre, which is what I want to do with what we want to do with Slay House. I feel like is kind of what we're looking at. So I in some ways, I wish Slay House would have existed back then when you were reaching out, because I would have published it. And you said that, I mean, I feel the same way as a writer, like, you know, you don't want to say that the book is totally autobiographical, but there are pieces of you in the story. And then I've heard others, like I went to get my MFA. I've heard other people from like my MFA program say that it was, you know, as expensive as graduate school was, it was cheaper than therapy. So there's a lot to be said for writing for cathartic reasons. But where's that blend for you? Where is that, like, where does it stop being autobiographical, or how do you know for you as a writer what you put into like the story, or what you need to like put yourself into the story, or into which characters, or do you know kind of what I'm asking?
Yeah. Well, for me, I identified with the situation. I didn't identify with the character. So as I was writing it, it started out as a NaNoWriMo project, so a 30-day blitz.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, I went back and I read a whole bunch of books about writing novels and publishing and all these things that I probably should have done beforehand. And I was like, okay, so my main character needs a flaw. So I just written her as like she's this victim. And then I went back, I'm like, okay, well, this is all from her point of view. And so she is clearly not me, and the choices that she's made are not ones that I would purposefully make. But there are parts of me in it that I didn't recognize. People that know me well are just like, oh my gosh, Sarah is you. I'm like, no, she is not. She's terrible. And they're like, no, she's not. And they're like, oh, and her husband. And I'm just like, well, you know, like that's not my husband. And so I defended the kids. The kids in the book are much more easy to handle than my own children. So there's a lot of things that I try not to put in. But then I actively pulled out the characters that I wrote. Some of them did start out as people that I knew, or I would picture them in my mind. as this character is based on this person, like physically this is what they look like. And then as I wrote them, they evolved and they changed so that they were more, not generic, but they became their own people. So I find that a challenge because my mom, when she read it, she's just like, she'd like every chapter, she'd send me little comments by email. I'm just like, oh, geez. And she's like, and the parents. I'm like, those parents are not you guys. So it's.
I have had that same conversation with like literally everything I've ever written, like all the short stories and books and stuff I've worked on. I've had the same conversation with my parents. Like my mother would read it and be like, oh, well, now in this story, you do this. I'm like, Mom, that's not
it's
me.
It's not me.
That's
so that me. Is that something that just happens?
It sounds like that's a authors? Pretty. It sounds like it's pretty universal to authors. I mean, I'm going on a small sample size here of two, but
maybe even across a lot of different art forms. You know, an artist creates something, and then everybody who sees it, reads it, listens to it, whatever, they try to come up with these ways to link it right back to you as the person, and that's not that's often not fair.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, there's an interesting conversation to be had. I think. It just surrounding like you know how much of someone's work is them.
But there's also the whole write what you know. Mantra, and I was writing one recently, and I was like, it's fine. Where's it going? What's this like? Why do I care? Like, and then as I went through, I'm just like, oh my god, I'm not writing a story about a 23-year-old person who's recently graduated from. I'm just like, because no offense to the 23-year-olds out there, but. I don't care anymore. Like I can't write a believable 23-year-old. I don't think because I'm not. I can look back and I can have memories of the shenanigans I got up to then, and the adventures that I had. But I can't invest in that right now. Right.
And let me say thank you, Karen, because normally it's either Trevor or I that's offending a certain population in one of these podcast episodes. So
well, you're welcome.
The honor goes to you today, so thank you.
23-year-olds, get out of our audience.
It has to happen at least once.
No, yeah. Just
yeah. It's we even like write down like what's who's the audience this
who's
episode.
Who's being alienated
today?
I had to rewrite it with a character who is older, and I'm not saying like as old as I am, but I had to change them to be in their 30s because I was like, that's closer, that's more, in my more recent memory. So.
Yeah, there was a conversation on Twitter, like in the writing sphere of Twitter that I tend to follow, where they were talking about like the age of a protagonist, right? And how often we see the age of a protagonist like constantly being like somewhere in the mid-20s, like to have a protagonist who's out of their mid-20s, like suddenly they're ancient, right? Like there's it seems like there's no real it's always like a struggle to build a protagonist who isn't super young. The recent Hawkeye show, right, for example, like you have Jeremy Renner, who I don't think he's that old, you know.
I think he and I are about the same age.
I think he's close to 50 or something.
Yeah, so like he's in his 40s or whatever. But they treat him like, you know, like he's just ancient in this program, right? And he's with this 20-year-old co-star. And it's just so weird to me that I'm like, you know.
But is that a movie thing, though? Because you can see their faces? Does it matter more in the movies because, you know. You're seeing how
maybe
old
not.
The person
I just think
how...
it's weird that like you know we have this like 40-something protagonist in this show and they're treating him like he's dog shit now, you know, he's got no hearing left, he's old. Like it seems like there's only ever a real story about like you know someone who's like already super old or they treat like anything over the age of 40 is just like ancient, and I think that's weird.
I can say that's I think it's refreshing that they're doing it to men now, because that's what they've done to women forever.
I agree. I just hate that
if
it's
we
coming.
We want to go there, which we don't.
Yeah, we can go there.
And Karen, I agree. I just hate that it's coming at my time, and I'm also getting old. So now it's like they're treating men like that, and then I'm there, and I'm like, oh shit, you know?
Wait a minute.
I in my brain, I feel like I'm still, you know, only 20 or something like that. Until I meet an actual 20-year-old, and I'm like, you fucking child. Yes. Yeah,
I had a crisis. Weird. I was just about to turn 35, and This was not last week, but I was just and I was playing ball hockey with some friends in this league, and we went out for beers after, as we always do. And they're like, "So what's new?" I'm like, "Man, I'm gonna be 35 next week." They're like, "Holy cow!" And I was okay with it up to that point, and then it just hit me like a slap across the face that in my mind, at that point, I was like, "In my mind, I'm 17."
Right.
And not only am I twice as old as I think I am, but I'm only going to be twice as old as I think I am for another week. And oh my God. And my friends with me, they're like, I've never seen anyone go from, "Hey, we just won a game of ball hockey," to whatever that was so quickly. But yeah, and then I think, well, if we're talking about like aging, it's interesting to me to think back to my parents and how old I was when my parents were my age, and how they must have also, don't take this the wrong way, they must have also been people at that age and gone through the same things and had the same, because when I was little, I remember when my friend's dad turned 40 and we're just like, "Oh, 40, that's insane." And people that they've never lived, and now I'm just like, wow, I guess I had that all wrong.
So my mother, kind of unknowingly, as a gift to like her children, she started to keep a diary when she first got pregnant with me, and and like, you know, kind of tracked all of her experiences through having her third kid, my brother. So I finally sat down and read these diaries. I don't know, maybe 25 or something like that, and I was just so astonished, you know, to think like, here's my mother who really just did not know what the fuck she was doing, right? And like, and really had to struggle through it. You know, stuff like I fell down a well one time. No, that's a real thing.
And you're fine.
It was not very deep. You know, but
no, but it's just so,
it's yeah, no.
It was mostly
an experience. You know,
Was there a calling?
No, no. But in my mother's journals, she or in her diaries, she spends all of this time talking about my sister for this whole entry, like and just like the weird intricacies of trying to raise my sister and all of her weird, you know, kind of personality traits in comparison to me, and you know, she's like really marveling at how different my sister is, and then the entry closes and Trevor fell in a well today.
So there's that.
That's all the brain space she really dedicates to that. It's so funny.
You'll get your own page later.
Yeah.
Speaking of, all right, inside joke time. Speaking of intricacies. Trevor said that Trevor said that that you had some idiosyncrasies in your book. Do you guys want to talk about that for a minute?
I want to talk about that.
I should probably
my fingers type what my brain thinks. Like, I'm thinking idiosyncrasies and I type intricacies, and I'm like, well, they both start with I am, so
yeah,
and they're both cool words,
and they make me sound smart. So
yeah, I mean, so there were just some things that I kind of noticed as I was reading the book that impressed me in different ways. You know, I always go on Goodreads to read stuff. I'm going to preface this by saying, like, I read a lot of Goodreads reviews, not because I am really interested in like following certain reviewers or anything like that. I just like to know, like, what's kind of the pulse on this book? What do people think about it? And I ran across a 1-star review of this book of this woman who like didn't even finish it, and she was like, "This is not the science fiction I was expecting." And I just thought it was so funny because she like she gave it a 1-star review, admitted she didn't finish the book, and I kind of scratched my head and I was like, what science fiction are you reading? Because again, I know, I think it's the pew pew lasers that she was reading, and there are no lasers in this book, and so
no lasers.
Yeah, I think she was really pissed off about that, and I'm kind of like, man, talk about like missing the forest for the trees there.
Yeah, but you can't have science without lasers.
A review like that is helpful though, because people can look at it and be like, okay, so this isn't a hard like pew pew science fiction.
Right,
so I think that keeps the not the wrong audience away, but people that like that won't read the book and then won't review it badly because it's not what they expected. So
that's
a helpful thing.
So it just got me thinking of like what are some of the things that you do in this book that maybe, you know, people don't necessarily expect or you know, because I think there's a conversation I want to have with you about genre and genre writing in general. But before we get to that, you know, some of the idiosyncrasies of your writing that I found. So, for example, like your characters drink a lot of tea. It's like tea or wine. And I thought that was a right. Yeah, I've got my Duchess Grey in my coffee cup, too. So. I totally understand the impulse to drink.
I had wine
tea.
On the way here, so, you know.
On the way.
He's like guzzling it down from a box, really. Yeah, it is dark.
Box in a funnel with the convertible top down. And
he's got it rigged up Wayne's World style, the way they had the licorice coming out of the top. Yeah.
No, but, you know, so that was something it seemed like if you ever needed your characters to do something, it was like wine or tea. Like those were one of the two activities that I saw. I also found your characters were like really supportive of one another.
Yeah.
Which I thought was like, in retrospect, I was like, this is very utopian. Like I go to science fiction for the utopian vibes, right? Like I'm constantly looking for like a society that isn't necessarily ruled by the tenets of market capitalism, right? And like,
yeah.
So like, can we envision a space that you know is maybe more equitable or more utopian in its longing? And this was one of those books that I felt like, you know, every character in this book is super supportive of Sarah on her journey. And even if Sarah herself is not necessarily the greatest person, you know, like she's got baggage, she's got skeletons in her closet, right? She makes some very, very questionable choices that I think can really impact, you know, whether negatively or positively the people around her. And yet, even as she's struggling through this, she has this whole community around her who really support her, right? Like they really kind of put her first throughout this novel. I thought that was, you know, one thing that we don't see a whole lot of in a lot of fiction. I feel like, you know, again, like readers coming into this story and looking at these characters might feel like, you know, there's just no conflict here. And it's like, no, there's so much conflict here. It's just not conflict arising from people being bitter toward one another, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's like a lot of the movies you watch and like a lot of the books. And there's always a bad guy. And there's always somebody who's got this motive that they're trying to damage everybody else for whatever reason they give it. And in life, there's not always a bad guy. Sometimes the situation itself is the bad guy. And I again, like in all of my moves, it's amazing the people you find that are they're just there for you, and they're understanding and they're kind. And it's either because they're just like deep down really amazing people that I've been lucky enough to find, or they're people that have gone through the same thing or similar things, and they're just like, you know, like what you're going through sucks, and I'm a shoulder to cry on. So it's I don't think there has to be, it's like interpersonal conflict exists, but I don't think there has to be an antagonist that is a physical person.
Right.
And I try to tell my kids, like when they watch movies or watch shows or even their interactions with the kids at school, just like everybody is the hero of their own story. And that was kind of when I wrote Sarah, like she's the hero of her own story. And so the lens that she sees people with is not necessarily accurate. And I don't know how if I had a chance to go back and do it again, I would fix a few things to make it more clear that it's her lens that we're seeing things through, not reality. I think it's important to take a look at things like it's not that life is out to get you. It's not that this person's being mean or wants to see you fail. It's just sometimes the situation really, really sucks.
Yeah.
And you just have to metal too.
Yeah. Karen, that's an absolutely wonderful point, because that's something I try to instill in my, like my creative writing students, is that the antagonist does not have to be a mustache twirling kind of villain. It's simply, you know, everyone has wants and needs, and sometimes the wants and needs of one person conflict with the wants and needs of the other person. And that's how we get that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, to your credit, Karen, I think that Sarah is, I think she's a really three-dimensional character to me. Like one of the things that, I found, again, interesting about the story is, like, I did feel at times that some of the other characters were more one-dimensional than Sarah was. But I also, like, the more I read, the more I realized it's because Sarah is not as reciprocal in what's going on with them, right? And since she is kind of the narrative focus for us, so much of the book is kind of preoccupied with like Sarah's preoccupations, to the point that she, you know, she doesn't really grapple with any of the things that, some of her other friends are going through, right? Like, there's she's got like a friend who's going through a divorce, right? And as she's, you know, like reflecting on that, she's really not dealing with that. I thought it was an interesting, again, an interesting character study. As much as I was invested in Sarah's journey, I was also kind of like, you know, I don't know how much I would want to hang out with Sarah much, you know? Yeah.
Yep. No, I get that. No, when I started figuring out who she was, I was just like, ooh. And I'd be going to bed and I'd just be like, oh my God. And I'd say what I figured out about the character, because I'm... the discovery writer, the pantser, that I'm just like, oh, I have no idea what's going to happen. And I was just like, holy crap. And my husband's just like, oh God, what now? I'm like, and then she does this. And he's like, what? And then he checks and he's like, but I'm not the husband. I'm like, you're not the husband. This isn't you. This isn't me. This is. But because she's at first read, like she's the hero. But as you go through, she's only the hero in the fact that she's the main character.
Right. Yeah.
And she's she's been.
And like a lot of it is wrapped up in her identity making, which I think makes for a really interesting journey, right? So kind of circling back around to talking about genre a little bit, you know, this is a science fiction novel. I think it's either science fiction or speculative fiction. I kind of tend to use the terms interchangeably, but I think, you know, speculative fiction is like we kind of think about what would human society be like under different circumstances.
Right.
And so, you know, your circumstances, I think, are just kind of projecting out maybe a couple decades to where this would be possible. But, you know, in a lot of the conversations that we've had in the past, you and I, and also some of the stuff that you've written about writing this book, you know, you kind of don't consider yourself like a speculative fiction writer or a science fiction writer. You would consider yourself a different kind of writer. And I know that in writing this book, you said you were kind of embarrassed about, like, you know, there's a spaceship in this book. You know, you were kind of embarrassed about being associated with genre. So kind of digging into that, where do you think you fall with regards to your relationship to writing and elements like genre?
Ha. I'm going to say, like all other authors of today's day and age, I defy genres, and that's not okay. It's an unpopular take, but when I wrote it accidentally went into space, and I had to figure out how to make that work. So I didn't want to write a pure science fiction novel, because that's not the kind of thing that I read. Like, I read a lot of different things, but I wouldn't choose science fiction as my favorite. Speculative fiction interests me. And the whole way this one went was, like, if it's near future, even if we're on Mars, even if we're in a spaceship, we're all still humans, and we're going to have the jealousies, the fights, the betrayals, all the human condition. And again, it doesn't have to be a bad guy or a space monster or laser guns. But I was never intending to write a space story. I also don't like the term women's literature, so that cuts me out of women's fiction. So it cuts me out of a bunch of different things that I choose not to identify with science fiction or women's fiction. Mm-hmm. And then my editor is just like, okay, but we have to market this somehow. I'm like, yeah, I get that. So it's, I found it, it's a tough balance because it definitely doesn't fit into traditional women's fiction because people are like, well, I don't really like science fiction. I'm like, well, it's more than, it's not just science fiction, it's a woman's story. And then there's the science fiction fans that can't get through the first 30 pages because they're just like, well, this isn't exciting. I'm like, wait for it, wait for it. So it's, it happened by accident. I'm happy with how it turned out. And the writing that I've done since then, they have the same kind of speculative fiction, futuristic aspects that it's still people, it's still humanity, but not in the world that we know it. And it might be a future Earth, it might be a different planet, it might be whatever it is, but it's exploring that because that's going to be a reality sooner rather than later. And we're going to have to be, and like, we're not going to have the societies that we have now. We're not going to have communities or the outside space. Like, it's, things are changing on our planet. And if we stay on the planet, if we find a way to get someplace else, but I think the human stories are what I want to tell, in the midst of the changing landscape. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I don't know. It does. I mentioned earlier, like, I think this is the best kind of science fiction because, you know, I think what ultimately fiction should do is explore the human condition, right? To explore the kind of circumstances that we find ourselves in. Right. And I think that what is so great about speculative fiction or science fiction is that, you know, more than any other genre, I feel it is very concerned with, like, what is the human condition and how do we continue to exist as human beings going into a future, right?
Karen, you said earlier that when you wrote this, you wrote it for NaNoWriMo, but then you started reading, like, writing and publishing books after you wrote it?
Yeah.
So what's your background? Like, is it, do you have a background like writing?
Well, not technically at that time. No. So I studied human kinetics in university. So, like physiology, anatomy, personal training, like exercise performance, that kind of thing. And so when I graduated, I got a job in a gym and I started working as a personal trainer and did fitness competitions and worked with bodybuilders, and that was fantastic. And I swore to myself that I would never ever work in an office job. If I had to go to a job that I didn't have, that I couldn't wear sweatpants to, that I didn't want it. so that's made actually 2020 and 2021 really nice. So I did that, but after a while I burned out. I was working long hours. It was too much. And so I said, fine, I'll find an office job. And I got a job as an admin assistant, and typed and filed. And my boss would give me documents that I'd have to put onto letterhead. And I'd look at them. I'm like, you know what? Like, if I can just do a few little tweaks and edits. And every job I had, I became the last eye in the office. So as we moved around, as I took different jobs, I worked at the Privy Council office, which is our, I guess, the highest department to the Prime Minister in Canada. And so all the documents that would go up to him that would come through our office, everybody would pass them through me as the final eye. So my dad we call my dad Captain Grammar. He's always corrected how we speak, how we write. If you send him a text message with a misplaced comma, you hear about it. Like, it's amusing, it's fun, and we'd be at the office, and somebody would go, well, what about this? And how, I don't know which sounds better. And I'd be like, hang on, and I'd pick up the phone, and I'd have people look me in the eye, like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm calling my dad, just hang on. And they're just like, you don't have to call your dad. I'm like, no, he loves this stuff. And so if he didn't know the answer right away, he would call back in half an hour, and he'd have the whole background with, like, subordinate clauses and all the stuff that I don't know the words for. So it's, so in that sense, like, it's part of my heritage, is loving words, loving grammar, and loving it when it's done well. So that was that. So
when it's done good.
At some point we moved away from Ottawa, we moved out to Medicine Hat. I was newly married, we were starting a family, and so I started a blog so I could keep in touch with my friends and family without having to send emails to all of them.
Yeah.
I wasn't on Facebook, so I was like, convenient. Well, I'll just start this. Yeah. So people would be like, what's new? And I could just say, don't you read my blog? so over the years, I kept
Karen,
it. And just like you're saying about...
That is so wonderfully antisocial. I love it.
I really vibe with it, for sure.
You can find that online.
Yeah. I was like, when you have questions, you can ask me follow-up questions about the content of the blog.
And now you can say, don't you listen to this podcast?
Like, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
I'll send you a link.
So I would write these things, and just like your mom did with the keeping the diary, like it's actually, I'm actually really glad that I've kept it, because I can go back and look at like what I was going through when my kids were just young, when we were like on the prairies and that kind of thing. So it's been great. And my lovely aunt, one of my lovely aunts, she leaves comments on it all the time, and she'd just be like, you should write a book. I was like, well, that's nice. And then as the years... Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, I was just going to interrupt with a joke. I think it's really nice that you say one of my lovely aunts, because, you know, otherwise your aunts would probably start fighting about who's the lovely one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of them, and yeah.
Yeah,
your aunts can hear this.
I'll give a shout out. It's my aunt Chuck, and she's lovely, but she's she's like, you should do this.
I'm all like, the other aunts, go away.
Yeah. We'll get to you later.
And so I was just like, okay, and that got in my head, and I made the mistake of saying out loud, yes, I will write a book one day. And and that, for me, is how a lot of things have happened, a lot of really good things in my life have happened, a lot of challenges. Is I made the mistake of saying it out loud, and then the universe, like, and then, in my mind, then, there's somebody, there's accountability. And so when someone's like, weren't you going to? And I'll be like, oh. And so that's how I got into competitive fitness. Someone said, did you say you wanted to do that? I'm like, yes. And so I ended up training for fitness competitions, and like almost any challenge that I've done in my life was me accidentally shooting my mouth off about it first, and then someone coming back and saying, didn't you say? I'm like, damn it. So that's how the writing happened.
Live up to it.
I really love the idea. So, it's like, screw you, here's my book.
Exactly. Yes.
I just think that's great.
But you're that's also awesome. Telling us that if we want to get you to do something, we just have to call you out on it, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
You said.
Okay.
But I have to say it first. So, but yes.
Didn't you say you were going to edit though. Like 5 of our books next year? For
not. Okay.
I feel like I'm probably the opposite. Someone would be like, "Didn't you say you'd do this?" I'm like, "You got to know. I'm a pathological liar." Right?
There's a lot of Trevors.
I have no integrity.
You probably never fell down a well, actually, did you?
That's just his go-to.
Yeah, just need the attention.
Always starts a conversation.
Yeah.
So you've been doing the you've been editing longer than you've more than you've longer, done the than the book, right? Like longer than
yes,
writing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So and then I moved to London, then I started writing little articles on Medium, because again I had said out loud that I wanted to be a writer. And I had some friends come visit London. Like, just we had kind of the flow of house guests, which happens when you move to a cool city. People are like, hey, I'm coming to visit you. I'm like, I haven't seen you in 20 years, but yes, come see. And it was really good timing, because each of the people that came at some point of the visit, I would sit them down on my couch and with the food that I'd been feeding them, and I'd say, hey, listen, I took a chance. And I looked at your website, and I want to fix it. I want to just like rip out the first page, rewrite it, and put it up again. And like, I want to help you, and I want to get some kind of professional credibility to say that I'm an established editor. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And because you're living in my flat for free for this week, you owe me. So that's how I got my first 2 clients, and one of them is still like an ongoing client that I work for him weekly, and that gave me the professional, I guess, credibility for myself to say, you know what, I am a writer, I am an editor, I can do this. And so I started writing articles about health and fitness, and I posted them on Medium, and I kind of branched out that way. And then the NaNoWriMo thing popped up, and I'm like, okay, fine. Like, it's only 30 days. Like, let's just go for it. And it was an interesting experience, and I didn't do my research beforehand. I took a creative writing class in high school, and I liked it. We had to do English in university as part of our degree, and I enjoyed it. I believe we did study Jane Castanier. So we had.
There are two things that set me off. It's Jane Eyre and Charles Dickens. So ironically, we're going to talk about Charles Dickens at some point too.
Yeah.
because you love him so much?
No.
It's our Christmas episode.
I'm over here with this degree in literature and like, you know, I say stuff like, I hate Charles Dickens, and people are like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I legit said that to him when he first told me. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah.
And by people, I mean
yeah.
I read my first Dickens only about a year ago. We were, I had forced my children to watch David Copperfield. I think it was on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? Maybe this is okay. And then they brought home from school, it was a comic book of Dickens' work, and it was cute. And so I was like, you know what, I'm going to give him a chance, because I had tried a few years ago and I just couldn't get past the first page. and I picked up David Copperfield. I'm like, I want the biggest one. And I was in a shack on a pond. It was a school break, and it was, I think, I could say 14 miles outside of London. So it wasn't far away, but it was far enough away that we weren't in the city. And I sent the kids out to play in the field. Which, funnily enough, did have donkeys in it. And I sat down and I read David Copperfield in a week, and it was incredible. Dickens can write. Like, he is funny. He is wise.
No doubt.
We'll talk about this later. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll come back and have at you on that.
No, for real. I agree with you. I think he's a literary genius. I also just think, like,
however,
I just can't fucking read him.
So now, Karen, you are you're an author. You have your own website. You are for your editing services, right? Where can people find you? I think I have a link to you on Slayhouse's website, but where can people find you online for your editing services?
Oh, editing, that would be KarenHuffWrites.com.
Okay.
I'm active-ish on Twitter, depending on the day, at KapowFit. That's my old fitness days that has carry over. I'm all over the place.
And you are about to be one of the co-editors, or listed as one of the co-editors for Slayhouse, Tales of Slayhouse 2021.
Tales of Slayhouse 2021.
Yes.
So how has that been? Because I know you've edited different kinds of work, and you've edited, of course, you edited my novel to publish it.
Is this your first anthology that you've worked on?
Yes.
So, what has the experience been like for you?
Well, I think we talked about this, the three of us, separately, but this is not, the stories that are in the anthology are not my usual go-to. I don't do a lot of short story reading because, because high school. So, in Canada, we also have Alice Munro, who is she's the queen of the short story.
I love her.
Again, it wears, like, from grade 11 up through like 4 years of university, it was Alice Munro, and they're all like kind of odd and unsettling and disturbing. And I think that's the most important quality for a short story, is to be unsettling. That's kind of what I've picked up. So for the anthology, to read all these different short stories that are like, they're compact, some of them are quite brilliant, but you're just like, holy cow, like getting into people's minds and the plots. I found it really fascinating to see what people come up with. But I also, like, as a very picky editor and now a very picky reader, I'm just like, oh, what would I have done with this plot instead? And so it's kind of, it was a bit of a challenge at first to get fully into it, because I'm like, oh, I would have handled this differently. Then I'm like, that's not what we're doing right now. Like, I'm not, what I'm doing is helping choose stories that fit the genre. And so, so I found it a bit of a challenge at the beginning, but I really like the ones you picked.
I do too. I really love, because I know you're sharing with my email, with the editors at Slayhouse email, you're sharing your comments to the authors that you're working with, and I love your edits. I think I loved them when you were editing my book. I mean, they are just so, your insights and your comments and stuff are just so brilliant. I mean, you think of things that in the moment of writing, I don't think I thought of, or some of these authors have thought of, and you present it to the author in such a way that it's not, offensive, right? Like you're very no.
He's speaking about my feedback, which is like highly.
And I think that's the fear with working with an editor. Like the editor's just going to rip it apart.
Well, I try to keep a sense of humor first of all, and so when I'm working with the client, I don't just edit. I also put in things that I like or things that it makes me think of. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Like there's one recently that I read that I was like, all I want now is Skittles, because the main character, like Sarah drinks tea. This person just loves Skittles. I'm just like, oh, and so going through, I'm just like, damn it, the Skittles again. So there's things that resonate or things that call back memories, or if I have what I consider a funny story about something that's connected, then I'll put a little comment about that. So I enjoy that, but I also, I think when we write, we're too close to it. And I call it the third hand. For me, it's a third hand rule. Yeah. Is that when I'm writing something, I've got like she's got like both hands on her face, leaning back, and then she puts her hand on the guy's knee, and you're just like, wait a minute, there's a third hand. And if you're too close to the story, if you're the one writing it, you don't count the hands. Yeah. And so, as an editor coming in for the first time looking at a book, I'm like, wait, so who's Dave? Like this is like we're 70 pages in. Yeah. Who's Dave? Like, how does he just walk in? Last scene, this guy wasn't holding briefcase. There's continuity that you won't see. And especially as you kind of cut and paste, you're like, this scene needs to move up in the story. You lose something because there is an introduction of something or an object or a feeling that just doesn't come through. So I'm reading it with the reader's eyes. Like, it's like, what do I want to know? What if this doesn't quite make sense to me, do you mean this? Do you mean this? And so I'm looking for clarity and I want... I honestly want it to be the best it can be because I was like, this is like the concept is amazing, but the execution, like just, I actually, there was a book that was already in print and I, with Lights Out, and I reached out to the author and the editor and I was like, can you just pull that down for a week? I was like, I will spend the entire week just fixing the punctuation. I said, everything else is fine.
Yeah. But
whoever did the commas needs to be shot. And it was so like the punctuation was like it was atrocious, and I can't even nobody understands how upset I get about punctuation. But this was so much punctuation, so bad, like on the first page, just bad punctuation. And so I went through, and I was like, free of charge, give me an entire week, and it was a 500-page book. And I went through, and I was like, I will change nothing else. I will just move commas and. Like too many M dashes, not enough semicolons. And it was fantastic. And I came out of it like sweaty. I'm like, whew, time, done. And they sent it out again, like as a proper book, and the reviews jumped. People are like, oh, and all I did was move the commas. And like, it's just that kind of thing just drives me crazy, but also makes me so happy. And
That's so fascinating you bring that up because I tell that to my students like, I know, seriously, I do. I tell that to my students all the damn time. So I guess the important question is, I guess the two maybe final kind of important questions that I really want to ask, what are you working on next? And do you enjoy editing like what you've done with Slay House? And can we keep you working with us? Like, have we scared you off?
Do you like us? Do you really like us?
Excellent. Drumming fingers together.
I am going to start with the first question.
She's never coming back.
We scared her off completely.
We lost Karen as an audience member.
You're breaking up. What? right now, so I did NaNoWriMo this year as well. And that one has been, I didn't cross the finish line with that one. And I'm okay with it. It's well underway. It just needs to be shelved for a bit and come back to. I wrote something else last year, the year before, that... I'm in the rewriting stage anyway. So it's, again, human experiences. There are autobiographical elements peppered through it. It's going to be, I guess, speculative fiction.
Board. I'm so ready for it.
Again.
If you're only going to buy two books this Christmas, by Ground Control, by Karen Huff, and, or K.A.F., as it says
K.A.
on the
Huff.
Yeah,
yep.
As it says on the cover. And
A Mindful of Scorpions.
A Mindful of Scorpions.
By J.R. Billingsley.
By J.R. Billingsley. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So...
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, and to the second question, which we've all successfully avoided, I hope we can keep...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like you.
there it is.
You're fine. I like you. Don't make it weird.
All I need is Karen and our two Russian bots, and I'm on board.
Yeah, exactly.
Karen, as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you. We really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us today. It's been a real pleasure. I want to remind our audience that we are going to be, we being me, is going to be at StokerCon in May.
The Royal We.
The Royal We. So the other four might want to think about somebody joining me, because that means I'm representing all five of us at StokerCon. And people may not, you guys may not want that.
That may not go well.
So you can follow Karen.
At KPalFit.
At KPalFit. That's right. And you can follow us, Slayhouse, Slayhouse Litbits. We have Instagram. We have Reddit. We have all that good stuff. We have our Patreon, so don't hesitate to come and support our Patreon. And we've got the anthology coming out this month, so we're really excited about that. In fact, my hope is by the time the episode airs, that the book will be out and ready to go.
That'd be exciting.